Thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the OU's Department of Community Projects and Partnerships and Coordinator and host for SPIRIT. The OU started SPIRIT several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it as an online program for retirees, not yet retirees, baby boomers, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, everyone who's looking for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Since the beginning of the pandemic, SPIRIT continues to be the safe and ideal way for everyone to connect and learn together in a virtual setting. Today's program is called Creating a Caring Community, Supporting a Loved One Facing Illness, something unfortunately too many of us have encountered and perhaps may be encountering now, that's for sure. It will be presented by Eve Reingold-Kleinerman, JD, who is the Illinois Regional Director for Sharsheret, the Jewish Breast and Ovarian Cancer Community. It is an honor to turn the Spirit Forum over to Eve. Thank you everyone for joining us.
Thank you so much. I just want to double check, can everybody see my screen that is shared?
Looks good.
Great. Thank you so much for having Sharsheret and for myself on this morning. I'm excited to share some information, some tips, some tricks about creating a caring community, especially in our community, the Jewish community, which is a very important one. I want to start out, by saying just a few moments that although I'm speaking from the lens of Sharsheret as a breast and ovarian cancer organization, that I do want to point out that anything that I'm about to mention can really apply across the board. And I'll mention this a couple times throughout, that it doesn't have to be about a cancer diagnosis. It certainly does not have to be about a breast or ovarian cancer diagnosis, but that there are ways that we can create a caring community for anybody who's facing an illness, who's a loved one or a member of our community. And then I do want to mention that I'm going to give a brief background just for a moment about Sharsheret and why we have a breast and ovarian cancer organization, and then I'll jump right into our caring community. So for those who do not know, Sharsheret is a breast and ovarian cancer support community. We offer support across the world for individuals and their families who are facing or at risk of breast or ovarian cancer. That does not mean that you have to be facing a diagnosis right now. You don't have to be diagnosed with cancer to call Sharsheret. You could be the loved one of somebody who has been diagnosed and you're looking for ways to support them. You're looking for ideas and suggestions, or you could be somebody who is at increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer, or a carrier of a genetic mutation that makes you at increased risk for cancer generally. So if that may apply to you, you can feel free to call Sharsheret. I would encourage you to call and see if we can offer you some support in one of our various ways. I'm just going to start very quickly and share, you know, why do we have a Jewish organization for this? Obviously, we are all parts of the Jewish community, but why do we need an organization that's separate, let's say, from, you know, Komen or a lot of the other breast cancer organizations that are out there? And I do want to mention that as members of the Jewish community, we do have an increased hereditary predisposition to breast and ovarian cancer. We're not going to get into a ton of that today. Obviously, that's not the point of the presentation, but it is important to know that as a Jewish community, we do have that increased risk. So we're going to see more cases of breast and ovarian cancer in our community, which is also why it's important to have a discussion like this morning. And next is that, as we all know, being part of a Jewish community, part of a Jewish population, means that oftentimes the support we need and the care that we need is specific to our Jewish identity. And so we have an organization that is meant to provide culturally meaningful support. We are not just providing support in a blanket way for breast and ovarian cancer. Our support is very specific to the Jewish population in a way that we can make everybody comfortable based on how they are living their lives religiously. Very quickly on that hereditary predisposition piece, and I'm not going to get too much into this, but we should all be aware that as an Ashkenazi Jewish population, we have a 1 in 40 risk of carrying a BRCA 1 or 2 mutation, and that is 10 times the rate in the general population. So in the general population, that number is 1 in 400. while in the Ashkenazi population, that is 1 in 40. So it's really important to understand that this causes a 60 to 80% increased risk of breast cancer, which while we know that 1 in 8 women will face a risk of breast cancer, this is a significant increase compared to that 1 in 8. And then in an 11 to 53, and it really depends whether it's BRCA1 or BRCA2, which is why there's such a range, increased in the likelihood of risk of ovarian cancer. So again, we know that 1 in 72 women in the general population is at risk of ovarian cancer. But in this BRCA 1 or 2 space, which specifically applies to the Ashkenazi population, that risk is so much higher. It's really important to also note that we do have an increased risk for prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, male breast cancer, and melanoma. So this is not just something that applies to women. It applies to men. It applies to our entire community. And so we should all be aware. As I mentioned, generally, a woman in the United States has a 1 in 8 chance of developing breast cancer in her lifetime, and a 1 in 70, which is a 1.4% risk of developing ovarian cancer. So the odds are high that you will know somebody who has faced breast cancer in her lifetime, although somewhat lower to know somebody who's faced ovarian cancer. So when we want to talk, I'm going to jump into the caring community piece. When we think about the common stressors that come along with a cancer diagnosis. And as I mentioned, this really could apply to any diagnosis. This could be any sort of illness, especially a chronic illness that lasts over the course of years for an individual. The very beginning, from the first moment of diagnosis, it's that uncertainty of their future. And so you may yourself have experienced this, or you may have a loved one or a friend who has experienced this. That moment of diagnosis where you've heard from your doctor that you have cancer or you have a chronic illness and you don't really know what that means for you. And so for somebody who is facing that, it can be very unsettling and they're not really sure what to do. That is where we as a community come into play, and we need to help our loved ones face this and be their support in their community. So the other stressors that sort of come along after you get that initial diagnosis and you're not really sure what's coming, then you're not really sure whether your treatment's going to be effective. You don't even know if there is a treatment, right? Let's take ourselves, you know, whether it's in the cancer space, is chemo or radiation or surgery going to be effective? Or if we take ourselves out of the cancer space for a moment with another type of illness, there might not be treatment that is an option. It might be something that somebody has to deal with the side effects and the symptoms. And they're just going to have to face what that timeline will be for the illness, but there aren't effective treatment options. For those who are going through treatment, there are a lot of side effects to many treatments for any type of illness. Specifically, when we get into cancer, we see there can be somebody becoming immunocompromised, they have hair loss, they have all sorts of unpleasant side effects. I think that as a community, we actually have become a lot more understanding of that immunocompromised piece. So it's going to come up a few times, but I think that because of the pandemic, we've been able as the world to understand what that means. When you see somebody in a mask, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have COVID. It could mean they're immunosuppressed and they can't get any sort of germs into their body. But we as a community are more understanding of that, and we understand when somebody needs to stay home for a period of time because they can't risk exposure to germs. There is a huge amount of social isolation that comes with illness, whether that is cancer or a different diagnosis. Oftentimes when somebody is facing treatment or a diagnosis, they aren't really sure what to do with themselves, but it feels more comfortable to stay at home than it does to face their community. Whether that means not going to shul on Shabbos, and I don't just mean from the germs perspective. I mean, they don't want to face the pitied looks, the sadness from their community. They don't want to talk about it. They don't just always want to talk about illness. And so instead they don't go out. And so they feel like if they just stay home, then they won't have to face that reality. Of course, you know, and I'm not going to go through every one of these, but there are so many other factors that become these stressors that impact somebody who's facing an illness in an everyday sort of way. And so these are things that we're going to talk about, ways as a community that we can support our loved ones and ways that we can figure out around these so that our individuals in the community who are facing illness will feel better supported. So we're going to start with a basic concept that might seem obvious, but I think it's really important to talk about, which is that we need to remember that the person with the diagnosis always calls the shots. So something might seem so obvious to you as to what should happen, how you might take care of your community member, your loved one. But the reality of it is you need to take the lead from your friend or family member who is facing that illness. It's really important because oftentimes community, you know, as I said, can be that double-edged sword where a community is trying to come forward and support an individual, but the support that they're offering is not actually what that community member wants. It's not what they need. And so it feels overwhelming. It feels like they'd rather back away from it. And oftentimes it's very hard to say, you know, no, thank you for that support. That's actually a really hard thing for somebody to say. And so instead they might just pull themselves back and isolate themselves further because they're not interested in the support that's being offered. I'll give an example, and you know, it's interesting. I'm going to talk about it on both sides, but for instance, if somebody, you know, has a Tehillim group set up for them, but they didn't ask for that and they're not really looking for that type of public, you know, announcement of their illness on a regular basis, it might make them feel really uncomfortable that there is a community group that's getting together to, you know, talk about their illness on a regular basis. Of course, there's not actual talk of their illness at a Tehillim group, but that's could be the perception that somebody is feeling. On the other side, for somebody who is looking to have Tehillim said for them, a Tehillim group can be really effective and really comforting to know that their community is, you know, crowding around them and supporting them in that way. So it's really just important to let that person, the patient themselves, call the shots, let them talk to whether it's their rabbi, their friends, their family members, and let them know what they're looking to receive from the community. So we're going to talk about a bunch of different ideas of ways to support the community, but at the very basic level, you want to make sure that you're asking the person who's facing the illness what they're looking for as well. So the main ideas of how we address creating this caring community environment in your own community is to start, we're going to do three prongs. One is to say something, one is to do something, and the next is to support the cause. So getting into, before we get into those three prongs, I'm going to talk about who needs this, right? So we're more than just the individual facing the illness. So sometimes it is that person who has been diagnosed, right? It can be the individual diagnosed with cancer, the individual diagnosed with any sort of other chronic illness. But it's also the caregivers. If you keep in mind, when somebody's been diagnosed, the person who needs that extra support is also the spouse, the partner, the loved one, the children, and the people who are coming to provide care on a regular basis. So that actually could be a community member. It could be a best friend who's showing up daily to provide that support, feed them meals, and the caregivers also need support as well. So we need to keep that in mind, that the caregivers oftentimes get left behind by the community, and it's not intentional. And I don't mean that to, you know, sound harsh, but we often view the caregivers as being self-sufficient, and they should really be good. They're not facing the illness themselves, but in fact, they might be facing the emotional turmoil of the illness, and they also need support. So when we talk about all of this, we're still not getting into the action piece, but I want to give the little preamble here that we need to be really respectful of individuals' privacy. So, you know, obviously it goes without saying, but when somebody is facing an illness, there can be a lot of issues that come around. And so sometimes when somebody is facing an illness, they will first go to, I'll use an example for us, you know, they'll go to their rabbi, they'll go to the person in the community who might be in a leadership position and talk to them about their diagnosis and what they need. And it is totally okay for an individual to request to maintain their privacy. You know, please do not send out a shul email. Please do not send out a request for Tehillim or for meals. On the other hand, it's also okay for them to say, I'm ready for this, but not this. So I'm ready for you to send out a request for, you know, Tehillim, but I'm not ready for a meal train. Or I'm ready for you to alert the sisterhood who might be willing to arrange some community specific arrangements, but I'm not ready for a shul-wide email. And sort of any, you know, leads on privacy, again, are really up to that patient and what they want to do. And then it's also okay for them to change their mind. So it might be somebody who at an initial diagnosis is okay with the SHOL being very public and their community being very public about that diagnosis and the support they need. But then after things get a little different or a little bit more difficult, or there's a recurrence, they're not ready for that public announcement again. And so they go back and say to the rabbi or to the Rebbetzin or to the sisterhood, you know, I'm not comfortable with this anymore. So I'd like to pull back and I'd rather not have as many announcements about what's going on with my health. And really whatever it is up to that individual. And we should again, take the lead from the individual going through it themselves. So how do we say something, right? What do we do? This is going to be the crux of what we're going to, you know, be thinking about in terms of that discussion piece, but there are the right things to say and there are the wrong things to say. And everybody means well, but sometimes things come out and it's not really what is helpful for an individual going through illness. So again, and I can't say this enough, you're going to follow their lead. A couple of thoughts about how to speak about somebody's illness or their diagnosis is to, you know, you can say, I'm thinking of you. You can really validate what they're saying, but the key here is going to be listening. Every individual's diagnosis is different. You may know three friends who have been diagnosed with breast cancer, but I guarantee you every one of them has experienced it differently. And if you are assuming that person A's experience is the same as person B's, then you might have a reaction that is related to somebody else's experience with cancer or illness, and it's not related to what that individual is telling you they need. And so you want to really be listening before you're reacting. And you want to say something. I want to share that sometimes we get a call from a caregiver at Shar Sheridan. We'll get calls and it'll say, you know, my friend has been diagnosed with breast cancer, but I think she's really upset at me. And I'm not really sure what to do with that. And it's that the person who's been diagnosed isn't talking about it, but they still need to hear from their friends. And so nobody's angry at each other. It's just that there's this awkwardness. It's the elephant in the room that you don't want to talk about, but actually if you talk about it, if you address it openly and you just say, I'm here for you, I'm thinking about you, and this is what, you know, you were on my mind, then that can be really meaningful on both sides. And that way nobody feels that they're being left behind. And that can also help with that social isolation piece. But it's also really important to think about what we're saying and to not say the wrong things. So while it's very tempting to say this, what should we not say? The first thing I always say is, call me if you need anything. We are all tempted to say this. I'm tempted to say this, but it's really not the right thing to say. So if you say, call me if you need anything, that now puts the onus back on the individual who's facing the illness. And they feel like they have to pick up the phone and call in order to get help. And that might be something that is too much for them to do, but really they want the help, or they don't even have the energy to think about what they need. And so it's up to us as the community members and the caregivers to provide for what they need without even being told. What I mean by that is, rather than saying, let me know if I can ever get groceries for you, instead you say, I'm at the grocery store, I'm getting milk and eggs and some basics for you. Is there anything specific that would be helpful in addition? It means you're already dropping off their groceries. They don't have to feel guilty adding in, you know, the bag of rice and the broccoli, but you have given them this very open space to say what they need. You might say, I'm dropping off dinner on Tuesday. Would you prefer meat or milk? You haven't given the option of, do they want dinner? And they'll say no if they don't want dinner, right? But you're telling them you're bringing dinner. You're not saying, let me know if there's a time when I can ever bring dinner, because it's really hard to affirmatively say, yes, I'd love dinner next Tuesday. But if you say you're bringing dinner on Tuesday, most likely they will happily accept it. So again, the call me if you need anything can feel nice, but it's actually my least favorite thing for somebody to say to somebody who's ill. Next is, don't provide unsolicited advice. No two cancer diagnoses or illness diagnoses are the same, and no two people handle it the same. And so what you might have experienced with somebody you know, what you might have heard, an idea about treatment you might have heard, an article you could have read in the news, it's not going to be what they need to hear. what you want to instead say is listen to what they're experiencing. Ask them how it's going with their medical team. Have they, you know, talked to their doctor about any new treatment options, and then sort of take the lead from them about what they want to talk about with regards to their treatment or to any sort of care, but don't give them advice about what you think they should be doing. You also don't need to always be positive. Sometimes when somebody's facing illness, it's really, it's tempting to say it's all going to be okay. It's tempting to say we're davening for you and everything's going to be fine. But the reality of it is sometimes they just need somebody to cry with. They need to face the painful reality of what they're going through, not feel like they're constantly being peppered with positivity. And if you have somebody who's going through illness who's really positive and wants to hear the upbeat thoughts, great. But again, that's taking their lead. And so you really just want to listen to what does your friend or community member need? And then you're going to be giving that back to them, but it doesn't always have to come from a peppy, happy place. And then I think this goes without saying, but don't share sort of a tragic or negative story that you might have heard, whether that's a friend, another friend or family member, somebody else who's been through a similar type of cancer. It might be really tempting to say, oh my goodness, that's so scary. My grandmother was diagnosed with that too. And she was, you know, she only was able to fight the illness for 3 months, right? That might be tempting because it's the first thing that comes to your mind, but it can actually be really harmful and triggering for the individual facing the illness. So try to keep the negative thoughts internal unless somebody asks for a specific story or anecdote from that loved one that you might know about. Next comes do something. So we have talked about this a little bit with the say something in terms of the not can I do anything, but offering very specific ideas. And the thoughts that come to mind when we think about our Jewish community can start with, and I know I've mentioned this, whether it is a group of women or men or just the community to up Sefer Tehillim and daven on somebody's behalf. Perhaps it is when somebody's about to have surgery and you know that there's a surgery coming up. So there's a specific request for davening on that date or leading up to that. Sometimes it can be caring for somebody's children. Oftentimes that is the biggest challenge that somebody faces. If they have young children, they're not really sure, you know, how to get their kids out of the house and doing fun things. But if you are somebody that can take them to do that, again, steer clear of the let me know if I can ever take your kids, because that's the open-ended question. But instead saying, hey, I'm going to be going to, you know, the trampoline park. I'd love to pick up your kids and take them. Can I pick them up at 2? That gives a very specific time, a very specific action where they don't have to feel guilty saying, yes, I'd love for my kids to join in on that. So just keep in mind that you want to be very specific with what you're offering to do. And coming together as a community can often be really helpful. So sometimes you want to create a representative. So I always keep this and, you know, kal vachomer, when you think about somebody who has passed away and you're organizing Shiva, you don't have just sort of a mishmash of people delivering meals whenever they want. Usually there's one person who's a friend or a community member who is organizing and taking the lead, collecting all the names, making sure they have the correct meals at the correct times. Again, not at all the same situation, but take that idea and translate it to when somebody is ill and designate a representative who of the community, of the shul, of your group of friends, who can be that leader and take charge. It means that you're going to make sure 2 people aren't bringing dinner on the same day. You're going to make sure 2 people aren't offering childcare on the same day. 2 people aren't arranging Tehillim groups, but they're on separate groups. And if you had just joined together, you could have been more effective. 2 people are going to be less effective than 1 here, but 1 person who can really organize and try to create that team of caregivers throughout the community. Sometimes that leader is going to be somebody in a shul, could be the rabbitson, could be the rabbi, or sometimes it's really just going to be a close friend or even a family member who's able to create that, but make sure you have 1 person who's taking charge. Again, back to that specific offer piece, you're going to want to make sure you're stating something very specific that you're doing as a community or as an individual and not leaving anything open-ended. And then keep in mind that when somebody's treatment ends, specifically, let's talk about chemo. They've gone through chemo. they tell you they finished up their last chemo. And there's this concept in the community to stop offering those services and that care sort of that next week. The side effects and the long-term effects of chemo, radiation, and surgery can last for months or even up to a year or longer, where somebody actually still needs a lot of support and care, or their part of their treatment became less public or obvious, right? It's no longer chemo where you know that they're going every week or twice a week or every 2 weeks. But it's something that's a little bit more subtle, where they're taking an oral medication that still has really painful side effects for them, but it's not as obvious that they need that support. So don't just end the support until you're really confident. And again, taking the lead from the patient, that that's the support, that they're done needing the support, right? So if somebody says, hey, I'm good, I'm ready to be done with all of these meals now, that's the time. But until you've really communicated with the individual facing the illness, don't cut things short unless you're really confident that it's time. Next is, you know, you can formalize the community, whether that is through your shul, whether that's through a group, whether it's like the OU, whether it's through a sisterhood, whether it's through something else in your community, you can really formalize, you know, what care is being offered. And it's often really helpful to set up things through our many websites that we have available. Caringbridge.com is really helpful. That's usually for the family members or the individual themselves who's facing the illness to provide updates via this website, where they don't have to speak to everybody daily, weekly, monthly to give an update on what's going on, but they can type something up. That update can go out to the community and everybody feels aware, but without having to have the same conversation 5, 10, 15 times. Or of course, we all think about this in the context of when somebody has a baby, but thank God our community is amazing in coming together for individuals needing meals, but oftentimes it's a meal train. Takethemameal.com, mealtrain.com. There are a lot of options, but keeping in mind that if you can keep things organized, even if you don't have that leader in the community taking the lead, you can also use our various websites as an option to make sure that the care that's being offered is organized. I do also actually want to mention, you know, recently I saw that there was somebody who did not want meals, but they used the Meal Train website because they wanted to make sure they had fresh items in the house, but not necessarily meals. So they wanted to be responsible for making their own meals in the house, but they wanted to make sure they had fresh fruits and vegetables, which was really hard to manage. They could stock up on the basics at home, but they wanted to make sure that they had some salads, some fruit salad, some other options arriving, as well as flowers. And they thought that was really nice to have people sign up through Meal Train just to deliver you know, some fruits and veggies and a bundle of flowers, and you weren't necessarily delivering an entire meal. And so you can be creative with the meal train, put what would be helpful, but use these websites as a way to sign up and have assigned days for individuals who can bring those items. And then you can also support the cause. I'm going to say here, obviously, this picture is specific to Sher Sherrod in breast and ovarian cancer, but of course, whenever you're offering that support, it can be for any type of illness. You could be dealing with somebody who's facing a chronic heart problem, and you could be supporting, you know, heart health awareness. There are a lot of different ways to support an individual. But as a community, if you designate an awareness or advocacy event for somebody's, you know, concern, let's call that breast or ovarian cancer, you know, if as a synagogue, as a shul, you arrange a pink Shabbat, that shows the individual who's facing breast cancer that their community cares about the issue that they're facing. Sometimes, again, if we go back to that social isolation piece, it feels like their illness is so isolating because at that moment, it feels like they're the only one going through it. Now, we all know many people are going to be going through or have gone through breast or ovarian cancer in every shul because of those increased numbers in the Ashkenazi Jewish community. But in that moment, for the individual facing the illness, it feels like they're the only one. And so when they see that there is a breast cancer awareness Shabbat or a breast cancer awareness program, education program on a Tuesday night in their shul, they feel like the community is really standing behind them and supporting the cause that's relevant to them in that moment. And so finding a way to recognize that cause can also be providing emotional support to the individual going through the illness. Oftentimes you can do this in ways that are not, you know, educational awareness programs. You can also do things like creating a drive, whether that's gathering toys in the community to donate to, whether it's ShareShare or another organization that provides care for women who have young children, a care kit drive. We actually at ShareShare, and I run our Illinois office, we do a lot of drives for individuals who are going through chemo, and we provide kits for women going through chemo that have, let's say, fuzzy socks and hand lotion and chapstick and a crossword puzzle book so that they can be entertained while they're going through chemo, feel comfortable with the fuzzy socks, and have a little bit of extra comfort while they're going to their chemo treatment. So again, there's a lot of different options. They don't even have to be specific to the type of cancer that somebody is facing. I do want to go back really quick and tell you a few of the things that ShareShare offers for the community. That way, if there is somebody in your community, you're thinking about it from the breast or ovarian cancer lens, that you can also offer them some support through ShareShare It, because that's another way to show support to somebody facing cancer. At ShareShare It, we were founded as a peer support network, and so we still offer a robust peer support program. When somebody called ShareShare It, we talk to them about what their diagnosis is and what their interests are. And if they're interested in being matched with a peer supporter would be somebody who faced the same or similar illness, but about 5 or more years ago, and has now been in a point where they have recovered and are in a better place. And so they can be that peer supporter. We train our peer supporters, and so they aren't just, you know, calling willy-nilly. And that way the peer support can really be intentional and very helpful. We also have makeup kits that we offer to women who are going through chemo radiation that are customized for women going through treatment. And then related to that as well, we do a lot of kits at ShareShare It. So a lot of materials that are mailed out, our resources and support were all virtual, even before virtual was a cool thing to do with COVID. We've been doing this for many years. So we also send out materials, those toys I was mentioning for collections, we'll send out a toy kit for children of mothers who've been diagnosed. And it's a, you know, cultivated specifically for the kids in the household. If they have specific toys they like, et cetera, it's important for the kids in the house to feel like somebody's thinking about them behind the scenes, even while mom is going through an illness. And then we also have a financial subsidy program, which can offer very specific financial subsidies for non-medical but medical adjacent related needs. So for instance, providing funding for somebody who wants to do scalp cooling, which is a way to retain one's hair while going through chemo, or provide a human hair wig while they are going through chemo if they're losing their hair. We also provide caregiver support. So as I mentioned, oftentimes the first person to call ShareShare It is not the individual facing cancer themselves. And so we offer support for those family members and those friends who need that care as well. And then I should mention that the cancer experience does not end when treatment ends. And so we also offer support for those who are in survivorship. That's our Thriving Again program. Women who are thrivers, as we would call them, who are no longer facing treatment, they have survived breast or ovarian cancer and they're looking for support based on those needs as well. We also have a wide variety of webinars that might be relevant to you or to loved ones in your family. Sometimes they are fun, they're cooking classes, and sometimes they are very specific to somebody facing cancer. It could be about, you know, facing lymphedema after surgery, or the effects of going through hormone treatment after having chemo, radiation, or surgery. So there are a lot of very specific medical things that we provide webinars on, but then some of them are fun. Some of them are cooking, some of them are art classes, et cetera, but you can always check out our website and see if there's a recording that might be of interest to you or your loved one as well. So I want you to take from today and think about, you know, what are these ideas? Is there somebody that you can think of who could use a little bit of extra support in your community? Whether you signed on today just to hear, you know, whether there was anything of interest, or if you had somebody in mind when you were registering, to think about supporting them. And how has today changed how you're going to proceed and how you're going to talk to them, how you're going to offer that support in the community? And then I do think it's important to take note. Is there somebody in your community that you could recommend that they call SureShareIt? SureShareIt, again, as I mentioned, can offer support anywhere from somebody facing increased genetic risk to facing cancer, all the way through survivorship. So there are many different stages when somebody can reach out. And if you yourself are looking for support, please do that or share our information as well. And this is my contact information, and I can also take any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much, Eve, for just giving us a sensitivity and knowledge and just, you know, understanding how we should proceed, unfortunately, in these situations. Does anyone have any questions? You can put it in the chat either to Eve directly or to me. Oh, wait a second. Eve, do you have anything there?
I do not.
Oh, there was one comment, just a suggestion. When you were talking about Tehillim groups and emails going out from the shul, one way of perhaps keeping someone's privacy is perhaps putting out the notice with just a Hebrew name. So that's, you know, this way, you know, those who need to know will know, but the person might still have a, you know, an essence of privacy.
Absolutely. We just got a question in that is, what does a male who has BRCA2 need to be aware of and to check and how often? So I'm going to preface by saying I am not a medical professional. I am an educator on this. So the first step would be to consult with their medical professionals. They should be seeing a cancer genetics or oncologist specialist. But somebody who is a male and has a genetic mutation, it could be BRCA 1 or 2, it could be any of the others, there are many CHEK2, PALB2, ATM, et cetera, should be considering from my understanding, there's a step for men to have clinical breast exams. So it's not something that is just for women. I know that we tend to associate that with women, but for men who are carriers, that is important as well. As well as increased screening for the other related types of cancers. So whether that is a full body check from a dermatologist to screen for melanoma, colonoscopies to screen for any sort of GI related cancers, et cetera. These are all issues that sort of a cancer specialist as a whole. So I say that as, you know, it can be an oncologist that specializes in cancer genetics is generally what I mean there. Will guide you to your individual caregivers who are going to offer the screening. But I think the important piece is when we think about men who are carriers is that it impacts themselves too. So this isn't just what they're passing on to their children, but it's also for them themselves. And while it can be really isolating for women facing these illnesses, I actually think it's even more isolating for men because oftentimes men don't talk about these issues, specifically breast cancer, is associated as a women's issue. But for men who are carriers of a genetic mutation, it's their issue as well. And so it should be something that is not embarrassing, something that is talked about and addressed with their caregivers, their medical professionals. Another question came in as, what services do we have for male breast cancer? So that's a fabulous question. We offer support primarily to women. However, on the genetic side of things, we do offer support to both men and women. And what I would say is that we do a lot of partnering with cancer organizations that provide support for issues that we are not directly addressing. I would say that applies to male breast cancer, but also, to women who might be facing a type of cancer that's not breast or ovarian. Let's say somebody calls SureShareIt because they're a Jewish woman and they know that we handle women's cancers, but they have been diagnosed with uterine cancer. We don't just say, so sorry, we can't help you and hang up the phone. We would not do that for a man with breast cancer either. We actually are able to do research on their specific needs and figure out an organization that would be able to offer similar support for that type of cancer. So SureShareIt can always be that first stop for somebody with a cancer diagnosis. And if we can't help, we will offer that referral as well. I got another question here. Can Sure-Share-It be helpful to someone who prefers to do alternative treatments rather than conventional treatments? Absolutely. I think one of the strong points of Sure-Share-It is that we really meet patients where they're at. So that can come from either a religious point of view or from a medical treatment point of view. Sometimes those two overlap. Oftentimes we get people, this is why it's great that we have our social workers who are on staff that understand Judaism from all walks of life, anywhere from, you know, Reconstructionist, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Chabad, et cetera. We really understand all the different pieces. And so sometimes that means somebody chooses a different treatment path, and that is fine with us. We will offer support, we'll offer referrals as much as we can to peer supporters who've faced a similar treatment path. But we always just advise that patients do what makes them comfortable. Another question came in: at what age should our daughters do genetic testing when one of the parents is a carrier? I'm gonna edit that question a little bit and say, at what age should any of your children do genetic testing when one of the parents is a carrier? Genetic testing, when it comes to cancer genetics, is a dominant, it's a dominant gene issue, meaning it can be passed down just from one parent. This isn't like our recessive gene testing that we do in the prenatal space before somebody's gonna have children, let's say for Tay-Sachs or Gaucher. This can be, it not only affects the individual themselves, but can be passed down only by one parent to their children, but it can be passed down to both daughters and sons. And so the specifics about when somebody does genetic testing, the current recommendation starts at about age 25, but I think it's a very personal decision and there should be a very in-depth conversation with the genetic counselor. Genetic testing can feel really emotionally concerning for some individuals, and for some they really want to do it quickly, and it really just depends on where somebody is at. But there's a lot of conversations to be had, whether that's about life insurance issues, what sort of treatment options they might be pursuing, whether there's anxiety at play. There are so many different things to keep in mind, and so I think the conversation typically starts between, you know, 23 to 25, but I would say talking to a reputable genetic counselor would be a great start. And then that's where I would tell you, we do have a genetic counselor on staff at Sure-Share-It who can give some of that guidance. Again, all of these services that we provide are free and done by phone. So you can be calling. I know we have participants here from all around the world. As long as somebody is willing to call Sure-Share-It between any of the hours, business hours in the United States. So starting at 9 a.m. on the East Coast, ending with 5 p.m. on the West Coast. If you're willing to call us during our open hours, our genetic counselor can offer support, or anybody else can reach out to a local genetic counselor as well. I was also asked to share our phone number, which I'm going to put in the box as well right now.
Actually, Eve, yes, you can put it in the chat, but I'm going to ask you to give me all that information. We'll send it out with the recording. So
perfect. People, yep, don't, I'm going to do that as well, but yeah. I'm going to put it in the box right now.
I see it there.
And I also want to address, there's one more question, but I do also want to state here that sometimes in our community, it feels like you might know somebody who works at Sure-Share-It. You might not want your information being known. Everything that we do at Sure-Share-It is completely private. We do not share anybody's information, of course, with anybody else, but I can tell you, even on a personal level, when I know somebody has called Sure-Share-It because they called through me and I run into them at the grocery store, we proceed as if we've never met before, we've never spoken. So all Sure-Share-It staff across the country is like this, but if there is a worry, depending on where you're located, we have staff all across the United States. So we have staff in New York, Florida, Chicago, Atlanta, and California. And so likely there is an office that you could call. And if you call our main number, you can ask for any one of the specific offices, but there is an office you can call where you might feel more comfortable not overlapping with somebody in the community. So you can definitely make that request as well.
I have one over here. Yes. This goes to the comments you were making earlier. Can you address the frustrated feelings of friends of someone who is diagnosed with cancer when their friend doesn't want anyone to visit and hardly answers anyone's calls or emails?
Yes. So I know how frustrating that can be. I can speak to it on a personal level from both sides, that it feels frustrating as the friend, but there are moments when you have to just, you know, take that, don't take it with offense. And then hold on to your desire to maintain that friendship until the friend is ready. The feelings that come along with a cancer diagnosis are so heavy and so emotionally deep that sometimes patients just sort of curl into themselves. They don't want to talk to their friends or their family members about it. They don't want to, you know, feel like everybody's talking to them about cancer all the time. And even if that's not what you mean, just by reaching out, sometimes it feels that way. And this is where I would really say, as painful as it can feel for you, take the lead from your friend or your loved one. And if they're not ready to talk or be social or spend time together, don't take offense. Hold on to that. Don't hold a grudge against them, you know, in the future. Wait until they're ready to talk and then still be there. And I think that that's also where you can keep not badgering, but on occasion send a message. I was just thinking about you. I'd love to see you if you're ready. And it shows them that you're still there for them if and when they're ready to talk and have that conversation with you. Again, this is really where the decision is on the patient themselves. And if they're not ready, it's okay. But I know it can feel really frustrating. And so sometimes that actually is where it might be helpful for you as the friend or the caregiver to talk to your own friends or family members, you know, not the individual who's going through it, to express your frustrations, but not take it out on that friend themselves. We also got another question over here that, you know, what I've been speaking about in this program is obviously through the OU, but what might reform or conservative folks do and who would they contact? So I actually want to remind everybody, all the services at SureShare are open to anybody. So the support services that SureShare can offer are open to anybody, whether they are reform, conservative, orthodox, et cetera. You don't even have to be Jewish to receive our services, although the majority of our callers are. We don't even have that initial, what is your religious denomination question until way farther into the support services that we're offering. But when it comes to joining together as a community, there are definitely, you know, community organizations that fall into many different denominations that might be local to your community. Whether it's not a synagogue or a shul, it could be different groups, but from a SureShare side, we help everybody.
Okay. I don't have any other questions here, so I think that's probably it. I want to thank Eve so much for such a wonderful presentation, and I think we've all learned a lot. I do have a few announcements. So on the theme of caregiving, the Spirit has recently launched some interactive programs called Let's Talk, and we will be this is an opportunity for people to come on at different times. I'm going to give you the times and talk about your experiences as a caregiver or maybe somebody who received care, how you felt about it, give suggestions, ask for help. These are not recorded. You'll be split up into, let's say, smaller groups. You can say whatever you want in a safe space. So and everybody should have received the times in previous emails. So basically, we're offering it tomorrow, that's Wednesday, at 11 a.m., at 8 p.m., and Thursday at 3 p.m. We're hoping to be able to offer different times for people around the world, people that are working. Please register, and we will be sending out the Zoom links either later tonight or early tomorrow morning. So if you have any experience or if it's something that you want to just know about, please join us for any and all of these sessions. You're welcome at all to come to all three. So that's one thing. And then next Tuesday, which is Rosh Chodesh Adar, we will be celebrating in a very different way with Eli Leibowitz, who is actually a comedian. He will be on Zoom, of course, for everybody, Zooming internationally. And anybody who is located in the TNEC community, you are welcome to join us on site at Congregation Beth Aaron, and you'll be getting all that information. We'd be thrilled to have a nice crowd in the room, as well as, of course, on Zoom. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. Have a wonderful week. Be safe, be healthy, and we will see you hopefully maybe tomorrow at Let's Talk.